bag approach is. But basically, this talk is going to touch on some of the most common themes in my research, which is studying the physics of strongly correlated many-body systems. So it was a brief outline. I figured I'll go over the motivation for why I'm looking using these particular methods, as well as some of the success of what the fermion bag approach has done for solving the sign problem for the TV model. Beyond that, some of the success in terms of making more efficient algorithms for studying the TV model, that's the fermion bag algorithm, and then a future outlook with some other interesting quantum critical points that would be good to study and that I think we have the tools now to do. And then finally, some conclusions. So to reiterate, the goals are studying the critical behavior for strongly correlated many-body systems. And at least for computational work, when you do that, there are kind of two main goals that we're trying to accomplish. First is expanding the family of models where we can do calculations at scale in polynomial time. And then even if we do that, we still might have problems with efficiency and actually being able to extract some of the quantum critical behavior. So beyond that, developing more efficient polynomial time algorithms. So the method I've been using to do this is quantum Monte Carlo, and it runs into some difficulty, particularly with the first point, in terms of just finding models where you can do computations in polynomial time. And this issue is known as the sign problem. So briefly, we can use the quantum Monte Carlo methods to measure observables, where if we can express the partition function as a sum of terms with these, we can actually call those terms weights that I've represented by this omega. And each weight is going to have a particular configuration attached to it. That's the C. And so you can use quantum Monte Carlo methods to explore the configuration space of these Cs and obeying detailed balance and ergodicity, get some equilibrated Cs, and then you can calculate the observable using these omega weights. So these are the weights, but in quantum mechanical systems, how to choose them in order to get the quantum Monte Carlo to work is often not obvious. Especially in fermionic systems, we get plenty of plenty of the expressions of the partition function, plenty of these omegas end up being negative. And when that happens, we often get a calculation that scales exponentially with the system volume. So this is known as the sign problem. And part of the effort then is to find a new way to express the partition function in terms of positive weights so that you can have a calculation that is doable. So that was quantum Monte Carlo in general. To talk about the fermion bag idea specifically, it was originally developed by my advisor, Shailesh, for calculations in the Lagrangian picture. And it's proven effective in terms of it's proven effective for both of the goals that I mentioned earlier for specific systems. So for one thing, there have been new sign problem solutions among these Lagrangian path integrals. And in this paper specifically, they were Yukawa models with interacting fermions and bosons. Another thing is that they've allowed for calculations on much larger lattices than before. So this is an example. This is a four fermion model studied by Shailesh and Venkatesh Iyer. And this model had an interesting phase transition because there was a phase transition at which the fermions gained mass, went from a massless phase to a massive phase. There was a gap introduced. But no symmetry was broken. And so it was necessary to go to such large lattices to show that there was a second order phase transition and to show that there was this particular only one phase transition. So that's one motivation to continue to use these ideas. Another thing, so we'd seen the success in the Lagrangian picture. So we were interested in looking at it in the Hamiltonian picture as well. Because, well, from the last field theory perspective, one advantage there is that you can do continuous time calculations and you can get less fermion doubling. Another motivation is in Lagrangian picture, there's still no way to simulate one flavor of four component Dirac fermions. So a question was, what if we look at Hamiltonian models instead? Is there a model at which we could do this kind of study?
That example that you discussed?
Yes.
Was that in 2 plus 1 dimensions?
Yes.
And so this is 60 times 60 times 60?
Yes.
In the Lagrangian, what you call the Lagrangian picture?
Exactly.
So the difference, I know you explained that to me already yesterday, but the difference between Hamiltonian and Lagrangian means that there is one direction that you don't discretize, or is that?
Yeah, there's one direct, in Lagrangian, all three directions are discretized, and the time dimension is exactly the same symmetries as the space. It's all symmetric there. Instead of,
yeah, it's Euclidean time.
Yeah, it's Euclidean time, yes.
And then the Lagrangian version of this is where time is continuous?
The Hamiltonian will have
time
continuous. Yes. Exactly.
And both methods scale as n cubed?
What scales are?
The
algorithm?
Yeah.
Yeah, so this one actually scales as the volume cubed.
Space-time volume cubed.
Yeah, space-time volume cubed. Yeah, I'm pretty sure. And then, yeah, I'll mention the scaling in the Hamiltonian. The Hamiltonian ends up being linear in time, and then says the spatial volume cubed. Okay, so talking about then the fermion bag approach in Lagrangian picture, I figured I'd first contrast it with what is typically done in Lagrangian picture. And so this is the auxiliary field approach, which is what's traditionally done. And for the auxiliary field approach, when you have exponentials of four Fermi terms, what you can do is you can introduce an additional bosonic auxiliary field. That's what that sigma xy is. And you can sum over quadratic terms instead, and it's the same as that four fermion term. And so for the partition function then, if you have a four Fermi model where this S naught is assumed to be quadratic, and then the U term is the four Fermi term, you can rewrite it in terms of the auxiliary field. And then since everything is quadratic, you can then just express it as a sum of determinants where we've summed over the auxiliary fields. Something to note is there's no guarantee, what we've done is we've come up with a way to calculate the partition function. We can calculate all the terms, but there's no way to guarantee that they're all positive. This is just a generic thing for now. And so if they're negative, there will be a sign problem. Another thing to note about these is they can be trickier to work with because they're all non-local, so changes can be expensive.
Sorry, I'm trying to track this.
I'm sure.
So when you say you have a fourth body term?
Yes.
Quartic term?
Yes.
And you expand it as a sum of terms that look explicitly positive, perhaps?
If you sum...
You have some on the first line.
Yes.
The first equation, that looks positive defined. Am I correct?
Oh, this, yes. So this is the full partition function.
Yeah.
So this is going...
On the top.
When
you introduce the auxiliary field, that's still positive. It's a sum of positive weights, right? You introduce the sigma xy, and it's a sum over two values.
Yes.
Sigma, but each weight is positive.
Well, so right now all you have is you don't have the integral. So then you have d psi bar d psi. With these?
Well, I'm asking, can you confirm that the top expression is made of two terms which are positive?
Yeah, I think so. It's hard to, I guess, in terms of the Grassmann variables, it's...
These are Grassmann variables. So maybe some sign coming out.
Yes. Yeah, sorry if that wasn't clear. This is a Grassmann integral. And so this is an exact thing, by the way, when you have a psi bar squared. You get to zero for these. They have the Grassmann algebra there.
So then you are integrating the quadratic terms?
Yes.
Analytically?
Right. So if you have this expression and it's got a quadratic, this is always equal to the determinant of the matrix that connects all these Grassmann variables to each other.
Now you say that matrix may not be positive.
Yes, right? Exactly. Yes.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Sure.
So the way that you're decomposing it pairs psi bar with psi. We can also pair psi bar with psi bar and psi with psi, right? Is there any reason for just sticking to this decomposition?
Yeah, so so the way to get a determinant is to have psi bar matrix psi. Now you could have psi's with interacting with psi's, but then you'd get a Pfaffian or some other type of mathematical expression. So by expressing it this way, you get determinants, which are things you know how to calculate numerically.
So in practice, does the last step also, is it also done numerically?
This last step? So we know that this is equal to the determinant.
Right, but that's determinant of quadratic action in the presence of some space-dependent auxiliary field.
Yes. So if we do Monte Carlo, then we're going to explore the configuration space of these sigma fields.
And for given sigma field, you compute
the weight.
Determinant also numerically.
Exactly. Yes. Okay, so that's Lagrangian picture. In fact, there are difficulties for this as well, because if the determinant has very small eigenvalues, then you get close to singular matrices, a lot of the QCD methods to deal with this run into problems as well. You see this whenever you have massless fermions. So an alternative approach then, this is going to I'm going to mention how the fermion bag approach works in this picture. And so the first example where Shailesh used it was in the lattice Thuring model, or one of the first examples. And the main difference here is that we start with a similar type of thing where we have a quadratic piece and then the four fermion term. But instead, we then, instead of rewriting it in terms of auxiliary fields, we expand with this in terms of these products. And remember, since psi bar squared is equal to zero, this is an exact second line. So one thing to mention briefly is if we had selected a one for every single one of these, then that would be equal to just the determinant of the S naught by itself. So that's one of the terms. But then every time we add in one of these four Fermi pieces, it's equivalent to taking the determinant of this thing minus the rows and the columns that correspond to this four Fermi piece, because those are going to be included in the integrand, and so we can't include them there as well. So what we end up with is a sum of all these determinants of kind of partial matrices of the S naught. And we can think of that pictorially, these expansion terms, as like if the one is just the points by themselves, so maybe they're yet to be connected from the S naught. Or if we include the four Fermi piece, which has an X and a Y, we have a dimer piece. And if you look at a bigger picture, it'd be like wherever we have one of these contributions, it's like we've removed those sites from the picture. And what remains are correlations for the remaining sites. And this would represent one of the configurations, one of the terms in the expansion. So this is a way of re-expressing the integral over groups of the Grassmann variables. And then the remaining pieces, you notice signs we can get, if we've removed enough of these pairs, we can get separations here. And we call those separated pieces in the space-time area fermion bags. So those are the bags, and we're going to see how bags similarly appear in the Hamiltonian picture later.
So the red bars are the quadratic terms.
Exactly. These are all terms that were not included in the four Fermi pieces.
Oh, just one.
And so they might have correlations between them coming from this S naught piece up there, because that S naught connected everything, or may not have connected everything directly, but.
Oh, just that loop is just a hopping.
Yeah, exactly. there's some other subtleties of this method that are kind of interesting. So the way I showed you where I defined the fermion bags is useful at strong coupling. So because if we had many of these, we would get rid of many of these sites. And then the few remaining we could do as a product of these smaller determinants of the disconnected bags. On the other hand, if we only had a few, if it was a weak coupling type of problem, then we could use this alternative expression, which is the determinant of the matrix coming from S naught, and that's always a constant, times the determinant of a propagator matrix that is of the same dimension as the number of these pairs. So the more these pairs we have, the bigger this determinant G prop matrix gets. And so if we only have a few of these, this is a more efficient way to do it. And this, we'll see some similarities to in the sign problem solution proof for the TV model. All right, so that's the Lagrangian approach. And from there, we decided to look at the Hamiltonian picture and specifically focus on a model that would represent one flavor of Dirac fermions with four Fermi coupling.
Sorry, in the Lagrangian picture.
Yes.
So what aspect of the theory make this amenable to your approach, which is?
Right, what aspect of the theory?
Yeah.
Well, strong coupling and weak coupling. Now, there are also methods where you can set a background and do some things relative to that. But really it was, I think, motivated also by the fact that the auxiliary field approach has a lot of difficulties with massless fermions there because of the singularities. So the fermion bag technique was another way to get around that.
So your statement, that basis you have chosen is a sign problem free, is that right?
Sometimes, not necessarily.
But for this model?
For the Thuring model that I showed,
yeah.
Yes, it was sign problem free.
Okay.
Now it was that one, I did it because it was a simple example, and it's also sign problem free for the auxiliary field method as well. But by doing it this way and being able to break them into bags, their larger lattice calculations were able to be performed with this versus the other method. So that kind of goes to the second point of, you know, what we're trying to do.
So this bag method is useful to simplify problems, but it may or may not lead to sign.
Yeah, it may or may not. Absolutely. So we were curious to see if there was a way in the Hamiltonian picture then, since there hadn't been much success in Lagrangian models, to study the one flavor of four-dimensional Dirac fermions. So we decided to think about a Hamiltonian version of that model. And one type of model that can do that is the TV model. And so for the TV model, we have the quadratic term, which is hopping between nearest neighbors. That's the XY. That's what that symbol is with the brackets. And then there's also a repulsive term. So it's favored that we have a particle next to a hole rather than two particles next to each other or two holes next to each other. Now, if we take the free part and we put it on a honeycomb lattice, but with a constant T, or on the other hand, if we put it on a square lattice and we introduce this A to XY term, which is just, it's attached to the hopping bond, and it's just equal to plus or minus one, such that each of these squares or plaquettes has an overall sign of minus one. If we do that, add in those plus or minus one factors, then for the free part alone, without the coupling, in the low energy limit, we get Dirac cones. So we have the Dirac fermions. And so then, if we turn on the interaction, the V, there is some critical coupling, VC, at which there's a phase transition from massless fermions or a semi-metal to massive fermions or an insulator. And we get a charge density wave ordering. Unfortunately, sign problems have prevented quantum Monte Carlo studies near the critical point for a while. This model was originally looked at a long time ago, but they were on very small lattices at the time because of the sign problem. And then for V is greater than or equal to 2T, Shailesh and Uvavisa did solve the sign problem, but the critical point turns out to occur below this region at V equals 1.3T, around there. So spoiler alert, with the fermion bag method, we did ourselves find a solution to the sign problem. And since then, there's been subsequent work that finds a simpler way to see the solution and some other related methods. And I'll go over that result too, so that you're familiar with it. But what's going to follow for now is our original solution, because it's motivated by the fermion bag ideas. Okay, so yeah, that's my disclaimer. There is a simpler way to see the solution, but the following explains how we found it. So inspired by what we saw earlier with the Lagrangian picture, we're going to split up the Hamiltonian again into a free part with this quadratic piece of C dagger X, C Y, C dagger Y, C X. And then we can also write it just using an MXY hopping matrix to connect the two operators. And then we'll have an interaction piece as well with the coupling. Oh, I missed the V. And then from there, we're going to expand in terms of the interaction. And so we'll have a sum over K, and there are K insertions of this interaction piece. And it's like 1 minus epsilon H, so you get a minus 1 to the K in the front from here. This is the continuous time interaction expansion. So I haven't fully expanded in terms of the interaction piece yet, though. So in the next slide, we'll further expand Hint by introducing these additional variables, these S's, which can be plus or minus. And so if you look at one of these terms, we can either get plus, n plus, or minus, n minus. And n plus and n minus are just a second set of operators we came up with, that n plus is just C dagger C, which, you know, like you would expect. And then n minus is the reverse, C, C dagger. So we have a bunch of, now we have a sum of C dagger C's and C, C daggers, or any combination of the C, C dagger, C, C dagger, C dagger, C, C dagger, C, with various coefficients. And then so the partition function is now going to, again, have K of these. But now we have the two additional sums. The first is going to be a sum over bonds, because remember, the pieces were nearest neighbors. And so we're going to have an X1, Y1, X2, Y2, up to XK, NK, or XK, YK. And then we're going to have a sum over all possible combinations of S's. And I've gone ahead and written all the S's together that were coefficients as a prefactor. And then they're all the operators here. And we can look at one example configuration pictorially. If we think of this is the horizontal axis are the spatial coordinates. The vertical axis is imaginary time. And then we can put the bonds anywhere in space that we like. We can put them anywhere in time. We can have however many of them, and then we can have all the S combinations. So this would represent exactly one term in this expansion. Okay, so with this sum, what we do is we have a sum of these various traces of various operators. And so we need a way to calculate these trace quantities. And so what we did is we started with more well-known free particle propagator, where if you have one C operator and one C dagger operator at arbitrary spatial coordinates, and then you have some time in between them, you can write this ratio as in terms of the M matrix. Remember, the M matrix just connected the operators together. That was the hopping matrix. And then we have the spatial coordinates x, y here, and then the t separation enters in the exponent there. So that's just for if we have one C and one C dagger. So from there, what I did was I derived a formula for basically any number of C, C dagger pairs. And the way I've written it here is more applicable directly to our model, because we didn't have any time separation between the CC daggers. We just had either C dagger C next to each other or CC dagger next to each other. And so what you get, you know, if you have K pairs of them, so if you have 2K of them, what you get is a 2K by 2K matrix that corresponds to all the sites that you have inserted. And then the diagonal corresponds to the time separations of zero for each of these pairs. And so what you get is either minus 1/2 if you have a C dagger C, or you get a plus 1/2 if you have a CC dagger. And then the off-diagonal pieces just give all possible time separations between all the different coordinates. If you notice, they look, you know, very similar to what we have up here. And it turns out they're related to each other. The upper diagonal is related to the lower diagonal by these sigma factors. And these sigma factors are just plus 1 or minus 1 depending on the parity of the site. So if X is an even site, it's plus 1. If it's an odd site, it's minus 1. So we can now rewrite the partition function in terms of the determinants of what I'm calling the G matrices, and they look like that matrix I just showed you. And they were kind of similar to the G propagator matrices we saw earlier, because the more interaction pieces we have, the bigger the determinant gets. And there, each one is going to be dependent on a configuration of bonds, the S fields, and time. Oh, yeah, and just so we don't forget, the formula, the S factors did get absorbed into this determinant, just so you know where they went. So some key properties of this G matrix is that it is 2K by 2K, where K is the number of bonds that we have. And then we can write this G matrix, just as I mentioned on the previous slide, as a sum of the off-diagonal pieces, that's A, and it's dependent on where the bonds are and what the time separation of them is, plus the diagonal pieces. And the diagonal pieces are only dependent on those S fields, because it was C, C dagger, or C dagger, C. And so that's the definition of the diagonal matrix. It's just equal to S for that particular site of the two. And then the A matrix, if you remember, we had this relationship where the bottom triangle is related to the top triangle by these sigma factors. So we can write that mathematically by saying that the A matrix is equal to minus diagonal matrix D, capital D, A transpose D, where this diagonal matrix is equal to the sigma factor, which gave the parity for each of these sites. Okay, so when we do that, well, again, we have the partition function. And what we want to do then is go ahead and see if we can sum over the S variable, because we had this matrix and it had the 1/2 and the minus 1/2. But we know we could have any combination of S's. So we could have any combination of plus 1/2 and minus 1/2 on the diagonal. So what we can do is we can write just the determinant over the S, summed over the S portion alone, as the in Grassmann integral form. So we have G up here, but I've gone ahead and written it in terms of the diagonal part plus the off-diagonal part. And then there's a sum over the S piece alone, but the only part in this integral that's dependent on S is that diagonal piece. So I'm going to go ahead and bring the sum inside and rewrite the exponent as this expansion. And remember, we can do this because the psi bar squared is equal to zero. Now, if I do that, it actually ends up being very simple, because if I sum over just this piece with the sum, what we have is, for the plus one, we have one plus psi bar psi over two. And then for the minus one, we have another one, but this time minus psi bar psi over two. So actually, the psi bar psi's cancel. And what we get here is just a product over the number two. And so, yeah, I went ahead and did the product because there were two k of them, so we get four to the k. And so notice this is just the determinant of the A matrix alone, along with this factor of four to the k. And the four to the k will cancel out with the one over four to the k at the very top. And so what we get is a sum over determinants of just the A part of the determinant. Now, what we still have in terms of signs, since we're keeping track, is we still have this minus V to the K, depending on how many bond insertions we have. But remember, when it comes to the bonds as we insert them, every pair has both one positive site and one negative site. And so the D matrix, that capital D matrix that gave the properties that we talked about with the properties of A, had the parities of the sites on the diagonal. And so if there are 2k sites, there will always be k odd sites represented in the D matrix. And so what we end up with is that minus 1 to the k is actually just going to be the product of all the parities of the sites, you know, that came from the bonds. And that's the determinant of D. So if we combine that minus 1 to the k in the determinant of A, we can rewrite this matrix 3, or this expression 3, as the determinant of A times D. And then using this property that I mentioned earlier, because A is equal to minus D A transpose D, AD is equal to minus D A transpose. So that means that AD is an anti-symmetric matrix. And so we have no sign problem here. So that's how we found that there wasn't a sign problem at all in this expansion. I figured I'd briefly mention, since then there's been a simpler way to see a result, and some other similar models to this. And that comes from using these Majorana transformations. And so if you come up with a xi and a xi bar, these Hermitian operators that are written in terms of C and C dagger, then you can re-express the Hamiltonian in this way that has a certain, it has a psi bar x and a psi y, a psi bar y and a psi x. And these terms commute with each other. These terms in the interaction commute with each other as well. Notice there's no more one halves, it's just the interaction. And so what happens if you do an expansion is you actually end up with two commuting Hilbert spaces, and you can express each one of them as a Pfaffian, and you get a Pfaffian squared, which can give you, and since it's a Pfaffian square of an anti-symmetric matrix, you can get the determinant of an anti-symmetric matrix.
Sorry, what do you mean by commuting Hilbert spaces?
Sure. Yeah, you can do, you can come up with these, you can divide the Hilbert space into two smaller Hilbert spaces because these operators can commute with each other. And then you can do, so you have two partial traces multiplied by each other. And those quantities end up being Pfaffians instead of determinants.
So are these two methods, the your method and the Majorana transformation, equivalent over all models in terms of removing the sign problem?
No, they are not. So both methods end up having strengths in different sets of models. So our method ends up being applicable to more methods, to more models involving interacting fermions and bosons that you can't really see using this technique. But theirs also ends up being more effective for some other models with additional types of hopping terms. But yeah, there's also a separate question of what's the easiest way to compute versus what's the easiest way to see that it's positive. And sometimes those are different too. Okay, so from here, we knew there was a sign problem solution to this. And because of that, there was now a way to study a four-fermion phase transition that involved a single layer of Dirac fermions. And so that was the first time you could study this with quantum Monte Carlo. It's a new universality class. And so there were a lot of quantum Monte Carlo calculations that followed soon after. And these are some comparisons to various other types of methods that are not lattice methods. And so for the new values, this is the new and the eta critical exponent for this. It was a second order phase transition. And the new values agreed pretty well. But for the eta values, there was a discrepancy. So if you notice, three of these methods are around 0.3. And one of them is significantly higher, 0.45. And it turns out this 0.45 actually used the auxiliary field method instead, because when I mentioned those the new solutions with the Majoranas, they opened the door to also studying this method, this model using the auxiliary field method. And that was more efficient than the current continuous time methods. So this calculation could actually go up to larger lattice size than the other ones. And so a question was, what is the correct exponent? The other difference is these three are continuous time, this one is discrete, but this one goes to larger lattices. Additionally, if you notice, the quantum Monte Carlo methods all get significantly smaller values than these methods in the continuum do. So that's kind of another odd thing. So the lattice sizes, these calculations were done both on the honeycomb and the pi flux lattices to compare. But for the pi flux ones specifically, because that's what I'll be looking at, the lattice sizes ranged from 484 sites to 576 sites. And so our question was, could we find a way to do things on bigger lattices and maybe add some resolution to this? And so to do this, what we did was we took another concept coming from the fermion bag idea that I mentioned earlier, where we were able to divide the configuration space into those local space-time regions. And our question was, can we do that again here? Can we find some locality and to take advantage of in our updates? And so to do that, recalling what the TV model is, we actually did a slightly different expansion for this algorithm. And it's something that's especially nice about this model. You can actually write this first line as a sum over these very simple bilinear terms. So notice this is a sum over x, y nearest neighbors, and each of these bilinears only involves two sites. And this bilinear form is very nice for calculations, which I'll get to in a bit. And so what we can do is we can, and this comes from the fact that they're fermions. Any higher powers, you have a CX dagger, you get zero. So this is exact. You can write the T and the V constants in terms of alpha and delta using these expressions down here. And so you can rewrite this sum then in terms of, I end up calling each of these XY pieces HXY with a label to represent that part of the Hamiltonian. So if you do that, and this is related to SSE expansion, Lei Wang had a paper where he looked at a similar expansion to this, with the TV model specifically. So another way to write the partition function expansion then is in this way, where we now have k of these hxy pieces. And we're going to sum over x, we're going to sum over k, and we're going to sum over the xy combinations. And so the formula I mentioned earlier, there's a way to show that it's positive. There's also a slightly simpler way to show that it's positive using the Majorana-Fermion transformation. So I'm going to show that here since it's faster. When you do the Majorana-Fermion transformation, the hxy, that exponential you get, you can rewrite, and it looks like this, where we have the psi bar x, psi y, and then the psi bar y, psi x. Both of these terms commute. So we end up being able to do the same trick where we can write it as a Pfaffian squared. And we can write it as a 2k by 2k Pfaffian squared, where k was the number of these h's that we have. And since it's a Pfaffian squared of an anti-symmetric matrix, I mean, it's a determinant. So we know that we have a way to calculate these traces. There's, again, not a sign problem here. But how many, you know, what is the size of K here? What are the matrices we'll be dealing with? And it turns out that for this particular one, even if we had, say, L equals 48, an equilibrated configuration has around 300,000 of these HXYs. So that would have been 600,000 by 600,000 matrices. And, you know, we wanted to do even larger than that anyway in terms of L. So we kind of had a dead end here. And that's why what we ended up doing was pulling from another formula that is very common when using Hamiltonian auxiliary field methods, known as the BSS formula. So I mentioned Lagrangian auxiliary field method. This is the Hamiltonian version of it. So you have the partition functions, the trace of e to the minus beta h. And so remember, h can be written in terms of h naught plus h int, where h naught is the bilinear piece with the MIJ matrix. And then you can do, you know, an approximation of this, you know, up to an error with e to the minus epsilon h naught, e to the minus epsilon h int, and so on. And you can do a similar type of auxiliary field summation to represent the interaction piece in terms of bilinears instead. And so what you end up with, if you end up with quantities that are exponentiated bilinear matrices, and they're summed over a field. And so the key here, the part that we took from this method is the BSS formula. And basically, the BSS formula says that you can go from this trace of these exponentiated bilinear operators, and you can rewrite it as the determinant of the identity matrix plus all those M matrices exponentiated. And now, what is the size of this determinant? Well, the C dagger C, the matrix that connects those two, is going to be a volume by volume. That's the spatial volume matrix. And so this determinant, no matter how many H's we have, or no matter how many matrices we have here, is always going to be a volume by volume matrix. The difference is how many matrices we have in this product. And so this is the BSS formula for Blankenbeckler, Scalapino, and Sugar. So as a comparison, though, for what we'll be doing versus how the auxiliary field method generally works, is the auxiliary field expansion, again, is non-local. These matrices are going to connect, you know, all sites to all other sites. And so for these algorithms in the auxiliary field method, you have to go linearly. You have to go epsilon by epsilon in terms of your updates to get the ideal scaling. Now, for our SSE expansion that we do, instead, remember, this is where it kind of, where you see why it was helpful to rewrite the Hamiltonian. Because what we have is we have a bunch of exponentiated bilinears, but each one of them is only dependent on two sites rather than everything. And so you can rewrite them using the formula, using these M matrices, but each of these M matrices is going to be zero everywhere except for one in a couple locations that apply, that correspond to the X and the Y sites. And so when you exponentiate them, you'll get the identity everywhere except for in a 2x2 block somewhere in the matrix. And so from this, you know that just as if you had two of these operators, they'll commute as so long as they don't have any sites in common for the bonds. Well, the same works for these matrices. Any of these two matrices will commute as long as their bonds don't share sites in common. So this is where we can make the connection to fermion bag ideas from earlier. So we have our expansion again, and it's in terms of these operators. And I can make a similar picture to what I had earlier, where all of these HXYs corresponds to bonds that are inserted somewhere on the spatial horizontal axis. And then they also have a time location in the vertical imaginary time axis. And the thing with these is we know that they commute with each other so long as they don't have sites in common. So we can come up with the concept of a fermion bag here by dividing it into regions where, for example, with these two bonds in this blue region, the matrices that correspond to them, because there's no way to connect these bonds to the other bonds in the configuration, these the matrices that apply to these bonds will commute with the matrices that are in those other regions. So that's the concept of fermion bag here. Now the thing is, what we want to do is we want to get quantum critical behavior. So we're going to want to take beta to be large. And so what will happen is we'll end up with more and more of these bonds. I mean, remember the 600,000 that I mentioned for L equals 48. And what will happen is everything will combine into one bag.
So am I supposed to see the bags alleviating the sign problem here, or is it just?
No. So this is going with that second point, which is to improve the efficiency. So what we do is we introduce the concept of a time slice. And so we divide the imaginary time space up into a certain number of time slices. And when we do that, this is the same configuration from the previous slide, except notice instead of four, we now have eight different bags. And so what's going to happen is a sweep is going to consist of updating each time slice linearly in time. But the nice thing about this, kind of the gain compared to the auxiliary field method, is within each time slice, we can actually do an update anywhere within it. We do pick a spatial block as well. That's what this gray square represents. And so we go through randomly selecting spatial blocks to update. But then we can go forward and backward, you know, and anywhere in that block. So it gives us some more freedom in terms of the updates that we can do efficiently. And we can do the updates efficiently because, well, let me define these matrices to make the next part make more sense. But if we look at, if we say we're going to update this time slice in particular, then we define this MT matrix to be the B matrices for the bond matrices that applied to that time slice, in the product of those. That's what MT is. And then all the remaining B matrices are combined into this MB, and that's the background. So we define a background as well as the time slice that we're updating. And then it turns out that when we need to calculate an update ratio, we can express it as a determinant that ends up, this determinant, instead of being volume by volume, which is what the BSS formula gives, actually is only going to have dimensions on the order of the size of the fermion bag instead. The only other wrinkle to this and kind of that, improvement.
That depends on inverse temperature, right? The size of that bag somehow.
Yeah, so that's why the bigger the beta is, the more time slices we'll do. And so we always keep the time slice the same amount, the same width. And what we found is that even if we have a huge lattice, as long as the time slices stay the same, the fermion bag size stays the same as well. So our maximum fermion bag size was about 30, no matter how big our lattices got. So the only other update we did as well is there's the other problem with the BSS formula in general is there's a stabilization issue. Since we have so many of these B matrices multiplied, 600,000, or even in the case we do a 100 by 100, we have 2.7 million of them. And so when you have that many, you end up getting very large numbers here, and then we add one, and that's a very poorly conditioned matrix. And to get to, and we, what we need is we need the inverse of it, because this update ratio is dependent on this quantity. And so traditionally, there's an SVD method for stabilizing. We actually did a slightly different one where we built up this inverse of all the matrices kind of piece by piece from smaller. So we can write 1 plus the product of two of these matrices inverse out of some constituent pieces of 1 plus M inverse that are stable. So we could build that up. And then we can also actually, when we do that, use the fermion bag idea there as well. Instead of doing inverses of volume by volume matrices, most of the time we're doing inverses of fermion bag by fermion bag matrices. Okay, so that's a bit of the background of the algorithm. Now I'll show what we managed to accomplish with it. So here's some equilibrations that we could do with lattices. Now before, the largest lattices were around 36 by 36 that people had done for the TV model, and that was like a honeycomb type of thing.
And you're at some critical point here?
Yes, this is around 1.3, which is around where the critical point should have been. And so on the horizontal axis, we have the sweeps, and then the vertical axis is N bonds, so that's the number of those HXYs that we have. So we start out with zero, and then over the sweeps, notice that we've reached equilibration with two out of the three. The L equals 100 was more of just to show that we can do this stably, and you know.
And it was all because it's a Z equals one transition?
Hmm?
Dynamical critical exponent's one.
The critical exponent?
The Z.
Oh, yeah, I'm not sure.
Yeah, why do you fix beta equal to L?
Yeah, I fix beta equal to L because what we're going to do is do this for various L by L by beta. And because it's a relativistic thing, the time is going to go as L, like the energy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so previous studies for the pi flux, for example, used L equals 24 as the largest. So this was just equilibration. Now let's look at the data for the transition. So yeah, we choose beta equals L, and we use this density-density correlation function as an order parameter. And so it's going to measure, you know, the degree that we have a charge density wave ordering. And so what we expect is that for the massless or the semi-metal fermion phase, the correlation is going to go as 1 over L to the 4. For the massive or insulating phase, it's going to go to a constant. And then at the critical coupling, that's where we can get 1 over L to the 1 plus eta behavior. And so we took data for various combinations of L as well as V couplings. And so we've got L across the horizontal axis, and we've got our order parameter C in the vertical axis. Now, when V is equal to 0, we went ahead and did an exact calculation, and that's where you can see the L to the 4, the L to the 4 behavior. So this is a log-log plot. On the other hand, if you look at the biggest coupling we did that was definitely above the critical coupling, that's this one, you can definitely see that it's going to a constant. So those are kind of the two extremes on one end versus the other of the critical point. From there, what we wanted to do was test what the other previous calculations claimed was the critical point. So for the continuous time ones, they put the critical point at V equals 1.304. And when we do a linear fit there, you can see that, yes, we have a linear behavior up here, but once we've added in the larger lattices, it clearly diverges and starts to flatten. So we would say that's actually above the critical point and in the massive phase. And we had a similar experience when we looked at the 1.296 point. You can't see it as well, but again, the fit did not work once we got large enough. Now, I mean, we ourselves still don't have a very certain estimate of the point ourselves, but I wanted to add we are getting data for the 64 cubed lattices now. So then that's the biggest data that's been done for these four Fermi simulations that have massless fermions. Mm-hmm. And so what we're doing right now is trying to rule out the V equals 1.27 to show that it's actually on the massless side. So what we did too is we did a scaling plot. We did a curve fit to show to come up with our estimates for the critical exponents. So we expect this scaling relation, and so. What we did was we did a 7-parameter fit with this estimate for F, and we had 25 data points, and then these are the values we got, and it turns out that our eta was significantly larger than the previous two.
This is scaling class for many different system sizes?
Yes, exactly. So we've got V minus VC L to the 1 over nu over T, and then... So that's the conclusion there. From here, I figured I mentioned some future outlook interests. I was asked, for example, if with the auxiliary fields, the Majorana technique, does it give the same solutions that the fermion bag does? And they do have different solutions. So this is an example of some of the fermion boson interacting models. This is quantum spin interacting models we can do that might potentially be interesting. And then we also have an interest in some Z2 gauge theories that interact with fermions. And there have been shown to be some potentially very interesting continuous transitions that involve both symmetry breaking for the fermions as well as a confinement of the gauge field. But they've been very limited so far in terms of the lattices they can reach, and we have reason to think that the fermion bag technique will offer advantages for studying these. So in conclusion, we've had a new approach, and they've helped us solve some new sign problems. And then we've shown that they've been effective at simulating models as well. So new opportunities to study quantum critical points.
Thank you.
Are there any more questions?
How do I understand this eta value? Is that, mm-hmm. It seems big to me, but like 0.5 or something like that?
Yeah, so the interesting thing is it is more consistent with what the continuum calculations have been showing. Mm-hmm. In fact, with that 4 minus epsilon expansion, more recent, they had 1 loop and 2 loop. They've recently come out with 3 loop and 4 loop since then. And they've been pretty consistent with what we've gotten.
So do you have some general criteria that determine a given model have a sign problem or not in your formula bag?
Yeah, well, we have a couple of principles, Part of what helps us find solutions in general is if you have say, two flavors of fermions, and there's a symmetry between them, you usually get determinant squared, and those can be positive. So the question is, what other symmetries are important? In the case of the TV model, we only had one layer, but there was a particle hole symmetry, between the particles and holes on the lattice, and it ended up that preserving that symmetry was important to getting the solution, whereas in Lagrangian approach, you didn't have that symmetry maintained. Mm.
So that's a necessary condition, I guess.
Yeah.
But not sufficient?
Yeah.
So do you have example where that property is satisfied, but you still have some problem?
I'm sure there are plenty. I mean, but no, not off the top of my head.
So what do you think is the general strategy to? So mm-hmm. you have found some very nice representation.
Right.
Solve a class of problem. Mm-hmm. Is there some general strategy that you want to?
Yeah. So. In the case of like the fermions that interact with the bosons, you can do a fermionic part that might have a sign problem, and you can combine it with a bosonic field that also has a sign problem too, but it compensates exactly right to end up with a positive. So that's one thing you can do to find additional models. Another thing is just looking at new expansions, new ways to sum over the world lines.
Any other questions? Okay, well, that thank Emily again.
You have.